you've lost your income and you're not alone, as you know, that should actually help. A feeling that you are not alone, it wasn't your fault, gives you some freedom from shame, but it certainly doesn't give you freedom from the fear.
That was economist, finance expert, and top-rated Conference for Women speaker, Dr. Teresa Giller-Ducci. Hi there, I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. This podcast brings you conversations with some of the most brilliant minds who offer concrete steps you can take to improve your work and home life. We are extremely lucky to have Teresa with us to talk about creating financial health in times of crisis. We know that we're in a crisis now. There is an overriding anxiety and stress almost everyone is feeling, especially about money. People are worried about what this means for them and for the future of our economy. So today, Teresa is here to offer some wisdom and also empower us with some actionable tips to take control of finances in the short term and also create some long-term financial health plans. I think the place we have to start is with fear. Mm-hmm. There are people right now who are unemployed. We saw unemployed numbers basically rise to a straight line on the charts recently. We now have people who are being warned not to look at their 401ks because the losses have been so great. So what do you say to people who at this point are maybe gripped by fear and anxiety about what will happen, not only during this crisis, but after it?
I really want to go to people's brains right now. Everyone's going to be in different situations, but everybody's going to have fear to some degree. What's happening in your brain is adrenaline and other brain chemicals that come from your amygdala, from the base of your brainstem, and it's sending out signals, and the signals are saying, do something, do something, do something. And I want you to talk to that amygdala and say, this is time to do some things, but not others. So we're going to talk to the brainstem and we're going to say, the danger is real. Let's write it down on paper. But it's very important not to have that brainstem tell you to do something with your money. It is not the time to sell your assets that are very low in value now. The market has suppressed the value. I don't know if it's permanent. It probably won't be permanent. Right. After the 2008 recession, we saw asset values fall quite not like this, but really deeply. And the people who stayed in the market and people who actually even saved even more and bought more stocks did a lot better. I've done research on this. Did a lot better than the people who sold. So if we just look 12 years ago, you can learn from the winners and losers, and the losers sold at this point in the market, and many of them because they were panicked.
So then is it better to just not look at your retirement account?
Well, it depends on who you are. So if you are someone who understands that you're afraid, but look anyway, I'm in favor of having more information. You're going to look at your account and you're going to see that you've lost 30, 40% of your value. And you're going to think, oh, my whole dreams and plans have been suppressed at 40%. You would be wrong. Temporarily, if you sold now, you would permanently put yourself on a path of lower consumption and lower standard of living. But right now, you're going to look at your accounts and say, oh, they're low. I better save more. A lot of people's response to a wealth loss is to say, I got to stay on target. And so they save a little bit more. We call those target savers. And I'm hoping I'm talking to a lot of target savers out there. So looking at your account without your brainstem, but with a frontal cortex, you know, with the front part of your brain, could be a very good thing to do. So take you and your frontal cortex to your 401k, take a look and say, hey, now maybe is a time that I rebalance, that I actually buy a little more stocks and get myself to a 60-40 or a 40-60 split, no matter what your target was, and put some of that stimulus check that you might be getting towards more savings.
So there's also this sense of being out of control, right? That there's so much happening, especially financially, that we simply don't have control over. There may be some who have had their hours or their pay reduced, There may be some who've actually lost their jobs. There could be small business owners like me where my business is entirely event-based. My income went from very high to zero suddenly. How do we regain some measure of control?
You've lost your income and you're not alone. As you know, that should actually help. A feeling that you are not alone and it wasn't your fault gives you some freedom from shame, but it certainly doesn't give you freedom from the fear. So I'm going to talk to you right now. Right now, the federal government in both the Congress and the president and the Federal Reserve are doing more than they did 12 years ago in the financial crisis. We economists are stunned. You could push us over with a feather for the size of this fiscal stimulus that came out of Congress just a couple of days ago, and the speed and boldness at which the Federal Reserve is acting to provide you as a small business with a line of credit. So you may be thinking you might have to borrow. And the government is actually going to help you, Celeste, with sending you a check. So what I wanted to say to you is that we aren't sure how long this recession will happen, but it has the contours of a recession that will create a lot of pent-up demand, unlike the last one. So yes, you are event-based, but a lot of your clients are postponing their events, not canceling them. But right now you've lost income. So I can give you some tips about how to handle the $1,500 check, which is kind of puny given what you might have to spend.
Right.
And also how to handle your debt. So let me just talk to you as a proxy to talk it to other people.
Right.
You've lost your income. Let's say you have some savings. You are going to spend that down, but you're going to spend it down a lot more slowly because you've probably cut down on a lot of your expenses. We have a lot of incidental walking around expenses. That cup of coffee, that overpriced cup of coffee, you're now making at home. It's now 1/20th the price. That's such a small scale. Really, food at home is a lot cheaper than food out. So you're saving money there. Our hair looks terrible, right?
That's fair.
Yep, right. Got it. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. Everybody's showing their roots on a FaceTime call. That's great for us. We're learning to actually spend less on what we call personal care products and discretionary spending. Now let's go to your core spending, your mortgage and your credit card debt. Now, what I did to prepare for this call is to really help everybody handle their credit card debt. One of the first things that happened when I turned on my computer a couple of weeks ago was I got a pop-up from my credit card company saying that I could borrow more money. So credit card companies are wanting to lend more money because they live or breathe on two things. First, your debt, and second, that you can pay it back. And they're now conflicted between the two. So you can take advantage of that. I would call any credit card companies that people who have lost their jobs might owe money to and say, can you suspend me having to make a payment without extra interest for the next 2 months? And while you're at it, lower my interest rate. So I'm going to repeat that. Try to get your credit card company to suspend you having to pay them for 2 months without extra interest and have them permanently reduce your interest rate. That means the recession's working for you and you're making the bank take the hit on lost interest from you, and you're making the bank taking the hint of reducing the interest rate permanently for you. So since you're at home with a phone, do that. Everybody should do that if you owe debt. So that's one tip. The other tip is to figure out what your finances are since you're home alone and locked up, and see if your current way of living can be made more permanent, that you could really find out where those discretionary spending was and get a control over it. I'm a big believer in looking at your money every month. I'm a big believer in not doing anything with your investments except once a year. So look, record, this is the time to get a budget going, but try to restructure your debt so it's cheaper. Beware, that's my second tip, beware of credit card companies and everybody else trying to sell you more debt. You don't want to buy that.
What about mortgages? What can people do about mortgages that they perhaps can't pay?
Right now, mortgage companies have gotten a lifeline from the Federal Reserve. So they know that a lot of people will be at the risk of default, and they don't want that to happen. So if you have a mortgage company, do the same thing. Call them up and ask them to let you suspend paying them for a couple of months without extra interest. If they say, oh, sure, you can pay us in July, but interest is going to accrue on your debt, then just say, no, thank you. I'll go ahead and pay. Because right now, the mortgage companies are going to accept delayed payment, but they're just going to add more months to your term of your loan and get more interest out of you. So when you call your mortgage company to delay, ask them also to not accrue more interest. And then you're shifting some of that cost onto them and you don't bear it.
So for reductions in pay, I actually saw someone on Twitter saying, hey, don't use up your cash. That's the number one tip. Don't let go of your cash. So put everything on your credit cards. It sounds like you're saying do not get in deeper debt.
Yeah. You can't really believe everything you hear on Twitter. And maybe you should be suspicious of professors, but I do have a degree. And I also, in my research, look at thousands and thousands of people, and I can follow them over their life course. I follow them after the recession. I can follow them from when they're 20 all the way to when they die and retire. And I'm telling you, the people that avoid debt have a much more stable lives. And if I were a psychologist and I hooked up what their serotonin levels were, there's enough research to show that if you're out of debt, then you are much more resilient to downturns.
I should mention here, serotonin is the happy hormone. It's the neurotransmitter that lifts your mood and makes you feel better. Keep going.
So let me just finish that thought. That Twitter post is wrong. Don't take on more debt because that transfers income from you to the banks. Now let's talk about hormones, and we'll go back to what you talked about with fear. I'm not a brain surgeon, but behavioral economists have been spending lots of time on these hormones. And I'm also teach consumer spending and happiness, whether or not buying stuff makes you happy. And what we've learned is that there's two hormones, let's just make it really simple, that give you a boost. One is serotonin and one is dopamine. Well, there's a third one. That's oxycodone.
No, the hormone that's produced oxytocin.
Yeah.
Don't take oxycodone.
The oxytocin, that comes about when you're holding your baby or you're having sex. You know, it kind of numbs you out and blisses you out. That's the calming, narcotizing feeling. Dopamine is the feeling you have when you first fall in love with a handbag or a person. You want it and it drives you and you're focused and you want that more than anything. Serotonin is satisfaction. So we have dopamine is desire, serotonin is satisfaction. People who are a lot of debt tend to have a lot of dopamine. They'll take that credit card, they'll buy that dinner out with that love object, or they'll buy that handbag, hoping that that will provide satisfaction. But mainly what's driving them is desire. Satisfaction comes about with having a long-term plan, having mastery every day, and people with stable lives and no debt have a lot more satisfaction, but probably haven't had big doses of dopamine. So I don't know if that's what your listeners wanted to hear, but let's really distinguish between happiness that comes from desire and happiness that comes from satisfaction.
I want to stay with this theme for just a moment because most people at this point are dopamine addicts. Dopamine is the addiction hormone. It's the same one stimulated by slot machines, for example. And it's possible that a person could be addicted to dopamine, in which case I wonder what you think about this particular time. Obviously, understanding that this is difficult and for some people, this is going to be a tragic, terrible time. But also, is there a possibility this could be a way to break that dopamine addiction and create some new habits?
I am really looking at the academic literature on just this point, but I'd like to ask your listeners if they've had a moment to say, hey, I haven't been able to satisfy my fix. I went online, I went on eBay, I went on Amazon, and they told me they couldn't ship. What did that feel like? And if they got over that moment, it's really like an addict not getting their hit
oh, I'm an alcoholic. I'm looking for bourbon. I'm out of bourbon. I can't get it. Did you go over that hump and say, hey, I actually didn't need that blouse or that thing that I was going to buy on eBay? And if you have gone over that lump, pay attention, be mindful to that. And that is what people who break habits do. So I am quite interested in the fact that this is my moment, my experimental moment, when all of a sudden people had artificial suppression of demand. And I'm wondering if that's going to be permanent. It might be permanent with flight travel to take a weekend jaunt to Florida. People can't do that. That costs thousands of dollars. And then other kind of little consumer purchases. So it's a great question. I think the answer to your question is yes, this could be a moment that people break their habits. Cold turkey.
It sure is, especially if you're addicted to your Starbucks run every morning, right? Or stopping by this store. Are there other habits, do you think, that new habits that might be healthy for people to create during this time?
Well, one is this plane travel. That may be learning ways to connect with people, first with loved ones, because we're a big country and we spread out, our children move away, or we moved away from our parents and our family. We may have learned ways to stay connected without getting on an airplane. So that might help a lot. I'm really hoping that my boards will learn how to do Zoom and that we could cut our board meetings maybe by a third or so. I know I'm kind of looking at the stocks and the companies that are doing well. And these are little greener companies. Zoom that we're talking on is doing really well. And that's more green than Delta, you know, who's not doing well.
Yeah.
So I hope those habits change. But I think you went to the root of my interest is whether or not this forced reduction in spending is going to add to this kind of mindfulness movement that we've seen that bucks up against this kind of consumer spending driven by dopamine in search for serotonin. And of course, it never works. The dopamine spending usually just creates more disappointment and that feeds more desire. So plane travel, consumer purchases. We did see people hanging onto their cars after the last recession. There was a permanent decrease in kind of car buying. And I think this might reinforce that, those consumer durables. I'm really curious about what this will happen to house buying. About whether or not people will permanently stop wanting to kind of expand their house footprint in terms of expense and remodeling their kitchens.
Yeah.
When you remodel perfectly good kitchens, perhaps that kind of pressure will stop. That certainly will slow down. I won't see any of that, those kinds of what we call consumer durables being spent this year and I suspect next year. So I hope those are permanent.
How has this affected our view of the strength of the economy? I wonder if this crisis has revealed weaknesses, cracks in the system. There's been plenty of economists that have warned about some of these weaknesses, but I want to especially talk about the gig economy that we're in, that we have ended up with so many people either whose wages are so low because average wages have not risen anywhere close to the way that executive pay has. So we have this problem of fairly low growth in wages, but also this gig economy where people are not protected by oftentimes unemployment, but also not by healthcare.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. What has been exposed is that more and more people working as independent contractors really makes the economy a lot weaker. Because let's take the example of someone who works in a non-union airline and a person who works for a unionized auto company. The auto company workers begged Ford and Chrysler and GM to shut down their plants 3 weeks ago to protect the workers from COVID because they knew that they would get supplemental unemployment benefits. If they would get unemployment insurance, their health care would still be paid by the employer with some assist from the federal government, and the federal government would help their companies and their relationship. So they had all the institutions set in place to weather a recession. They had social and private insurance. The worker who worked as a contractor for a non-union airline they were first to be fired, and they had no connection with their employer. They didn't get supplemental unemployment. They may have not been counted as a real employee to get unemployment insurance. They might have just been hired, so they weren't eligible, and they don't have health care coverage except for the government. So one, we are finding that if we don't have an employer-employee relationship, recessions are a lot worse. And two, we have found out, this is more permanent, that the government is a much more important partner of capitalism than we ever imagined. That capitalism as we know it would be flat on its face if it wasn't for the Federal Reserve and Congress and international governmental organizations coming to its rescue. So we're going to see this big shift from private activity to government activity, and we're going to see the capitalists embrace the government. So I've seen a permanent shift in our attitudes towards government, because Republicans now are sounding like Democrats. So run the printing presses, sell the government debt, do whatever it takes to give people income. I'm seeing an amazing amount of bipartisanship, but lurking behind that is more attention needed to the structure of the workforce, where we cannot live on 30% of our workers being in the shadows on the margins and not counted. We're going to have to make those sectors much more formal.
Which, ironically enough, is capitalist, which is an economic principle, embracing more of the political principle of socialism is what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like authoritarian socialism in a way. Like $500 billion of that big stimulus is now in the discretion of the president and the Treasury Secretary. So Trump and Mnuchin now have control over what kinds of subsidies they're going to give to what companies. And that's where the one party is probably won over the other. I'm not really a partisan here. I'm really an economist. But we don't need socialism to restructure our workforce and to make them more permanent. We can just look to Germany. They have a system, I'm not going to mispronounce the German word for it, but it's work sharing. So they have already have in the system telling them, first of all, it's really hard to be an independent contractor. Almost everybody is legally a worker.
And heavily unionized.
Well, that's not unrelated, right?
Right.
Yeah. That they've been able to lobby for government policies to make sure that the people who work have a formal relationship, you know, with their employer. But what they have is a work sharing program where if a company is going to lay off 10% of their employees, they just go to a fund and say, oh, instead of laying them off, because I don't have any sales, I'm in a recession, I'm just going to draw from this fund to pay their wages. So now in Germany, everybody is still an employee, but their wages are coming from this fund, partly funded by government, partly funded by past contributions. And I'm not disconnected from my pension plan or disconnected from my health insurance or disconnected from my skill and disconnected from my employer. And we still have an ongoing relationship. We're going to wait it out and then life resumes smoothly back to normal. So we don't even have to be socialists. We can just be a different kind of capitalism. And I'm looking forward to the next conversation being, how do we have these programs that are permanent? Because it's not good to send out checks. That's a panic kind of response, and it's not permanent. Nobody can really count on it. It doesn't make the economy more stable in the future.
Yeah, it doesn't pay rent in New York. Can we bring this back down to the micro level for people who are listening again? Because these are all things that we all have to think about as a nation. And I think it's good that you average person that doesn't generally think about the way our economy is structured or think too much about the power balance between employee and employer. I think it's good that those topics are coming up and being discussed. On the other hand, the timeline belongs to the virus at this point.
Right. Let's talk about a person being at home who lost 50% of their household income and may lose the other 50% because their partner, their economic partner, their spouse, their partner will lose a job. It's really important for you not to be financially predated on. That's a real concern I have of elders. And I'm going to put credit card companies that are trying to sell you more debt in that category of predation. It's not illegal, but it's going to offer your brainstem, your fear, amygdala, some short-term relief. Try not to go into debt. Use your cash. be mindful of your dopamine-driven consumer expenditure. At the same time, think about your collective self. I think that thinking about how this will affect the whole economy gives content to our life that is really consumed by the latest, you know, case numbers in our area. So my tips right now is to, if you can quell your fear, look at your financial accounts, monitor your financial accounts. This is a time where credit card companies or your magazine subscription are going to want to automatically renew and automatically renew quickly. So follow your accounts very closely. If you can, look at your 401k accounts and make sure you know how much more you have to save to get on target. Know that your asset values will probably come back in a year and a half. Be patient. The other tips are to try to reduce. It's going to be hard to increase your income to get a second job or any of that, but try to reduce your spending on a permanent basis.
Should one keep one's cash to the extent of not paying a bill?
Yeah, and then the other tip was what I said before, was to try to restructure your bill paying with your mortgage company, with your credit card company, with maybe even your landlord without incurring more debt.
But if you can't, do you go into arrears?
No. Do preserve your credit score. I get it. I see your question. No, try to preserve your credit score. You should be on the phone with very nice negotiations with all of your debtors so that if you do go into arrears, it doesn't affect your credit score. Make it all formal. Don't just avoid a withdrawal.
Last question for you. I mean, as a behavioral economist, do you have any tips for how to handle the fear? I mean, other than deep breathing, what does one do?
No, you have to do something, but you have to do something for your medium term and your longer self. So you have to empathize with your future self, even if it's for the next 3 months or when you're retired. So empathize with your future self, be an adult, and be a good manager. So this is the time to create a good budget. If you don't have it already on your Excel file or you don't have Quicken, this is the time to set all that up. And then also be a good manager of your wealth budget, which is to make sure you know your target wealth that you need when you do retire and make sure that you're acting to meet your goals. So action is important, even if it's motivated by fear, but make sure it's adult action and it's taking care of your medium and your future self, not your current scared child self.
Okay, Teresa, thank you so very much. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Celeste. Those were very smart questions. I hope I dignified them with smart answers.
Dr. Teresa Ghilarducci is a finance expert, author, and the chair in economic policy analysis at the New School for Social Research. If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe. That helps other people find us. Also, be sure to check out more offerings from one of the conferences for women near you. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation, drawing more than 45,000 women and men to its annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and Silicon Valley. For now, I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.